I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The latest round of talks on Syria's future are scheduled to get underway Thursday in Geneva. UN envoy Stefan de Mistura Wednesday was asked if he expected a breakthrough to end nearly 6 years of war.
Am I expecting a breakthrough? No, I'm not expecting a breakthrough. But I'm expecting and determined for keeping a very proactive momentum.
The UN diplomat said those trying to end the bloodshed are trying to outpace what he called the spoilers bent on derailing the peace process. These are the first political talks involving the government and opposition in nearly a year. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal said much has changed.
Syria is now a different ballgame, and the United Nations and the UN representative is standing still in its old place. That particular organization hasn't moved. It is becoming increasingly irrelevant.
He said new realities on the ground cannot be taken care of in Geneva. The opposition spokesman, Salem El Meslet, said they're looking for direct talks with the government.
We came hoping to see something positive for the Syrian people here in Geneva. We don't want this round to be like the last one. We want this one. We request and we want direct talks. Direct negotiation.
He said he hopes this fourth round will involve serious negotiations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned Wednesday 20 million people in four countries face famine unless the international community steps in to prevent it.
Famine is already a reality in parts of South Sudan. Unless we act now, it is only a matter of time until it affects other areas and other countries.
The UN declared South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and the northeast part of Nigeria on the brink of famine in the next 6 months. The UN chief said a staggering $4.4 billion is needed by the end of March. This is VOA News. Two senior members of the Trump administration are in Latin America amid concerns about the U.S. crackdown on illegal immigration. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Mexico a day after new guidelines were made public for the building of a border wall to slow the flow of illegal immigrants and removing those undocumented migrants who pose a threat to public safety. Homeland Security Secretary Jack Kelly was in Guatemala Wednesday, insisting mass deportations are not underway, but he did bring a message.
My advice is to not take the risk with your own life or the life of your precious children to make this very, very dangerous journey.
Kelly said if you're Guatemalan and considering paying a lot of money to a smuggler to bring you to the U.S., you'll be wasting your money because you'll be returned quickly. Pakistan's military said paramilitary forces have launched a nationwide anti-terrorist operation in Punjab province. The decision follows a series of attacks that have killed more than 100 people in the past week, including an attack on a Sufi shrine in Sindh province that left at least 90 dead. The attack was claimed by Islamic State. French centrist politician François Bayrou, a former education minister who has run as presidential candidate in the past, has thrown his support to independent presidential hopeful Emmanuel Macron.
Cette situation nourrit le pire des risques.
Bayrou warned against what he called an outburst of extreme right and the danger the election could lead to the dismantling of the European Union. His support could boost Macron's chances of reaching a May runoff between two finalists following April's first round. Opinion polls put him close to conservative candidate François Fillon, a former prime minister, and the National Front's Marine Le Pen. Thousands of mourners gathered Wednesday in the Egyptian town of El Gamalia for the funeral of Muslim cleric Omar Abdel Rahman. The so-called blind sheikh's body was returned from a prison in the U.S. state of North Carolina, where he'd been serving a life sentence on several terrorism-related charges stemming from the 1993 World Trade Center bombing in New York that killed six and wounded hundreds. Abdel Rahman died Saturday at age 78. Turkey says it's now allowing female soldiers to wear a headscarf with their uniforms, a change in regulations that is seen as a result of the influence of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Islamist-based ruling Justice and Development Party. The regulation is voluntary. Headscarves had long been banned in Turkish society, which, while majority Muslim, is officially secular. Wall Street continued in record territory Wednesday, with the benchmark Dow Jones Index closing at another record high of 20,775. Meanwhile, the minutes released following the latest U.S. central bank's meeting indicates a hike in a key interest rate is imminent if the economy remains strong. Fed policymakers met January 31 and February 1st. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa, welcome. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN mission in South Sudan says government bureaucracy is delaying aid distribution to needy families.
I would be delighted if we were able to see a reduction in the number of those violations. And so we were able to say to the Security Council, the situation is getting better.
David Shearer is the new UN Special Representative for South Sudan. Tanzania's government is urged to provide grains to the country's drought-stricken citizens. Malawi's agriculture minister is fired over a suspicious maize procurement program. And a Ugandan church leader welcomes reports of a possible dialogue between Chisa Besigye and President Yoweri Museveni.
We are tired of this conflict, hatred, division based on political parties. So dialogue would be the best means to solve this problem between diseases and then President Museveni.
Monsignor Matthew Odong is vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu in northern Uganda, and the head of U.S. Africa Command says rival Libyan factions must work together. Those stories, plus our Black History Month facts and trivia questions, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The head of the United Nations mission to South Sudan says the South Sudan government should take practical steps to ensure aid agencies can reach the country's starving population. The army's chief says the government is still blocking aid agencies by delaying paperwork that aid agencies need to distribute relief items to families in need. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
David Sierra, the new UN Special Representative for South Sudan, says the South Sudanese government authorities continue to hinder aid agencies from delivering services across the country. He says several military checkpoints have been erected in areas hard hit by food shortages. He also accuses government bureaucrats of holding up aid workers with the paperwork. Sierra says in the past few days, he has had to personally intervene on behalf of enemies workers trying to access places where people are starving. He says the government blocked the UN mission from reaching Wau Siluk when the UN wanted to assess the humanitarian conditions of people in the area.
I would be delighted if we were able to see a reduction in the number of those violations. And so we were able to say to the Security Council, the situation is getting better. I think that would be positive on all sides, both on the government side and on for the UN as well. So I would like to see a greater degree of compliance with agreements that have already been signed some time ago.
President Salva Kiir and SPLA-IO leader Riek Machar agreed to allow unfettered access to aid workers and peacekeepers to all areas under their control in previous ceasefire agreements. South Sudan Deputy Information Minister Akol Paul Kordit says lawmakers of the Transitional National Assembly have yet to draft practical measures on how to ensure that aid agencies are not blocked from reaching people in need of help.
The parliament shall convene another session to discuss the speech of the president. And once the speech is discussed, the parliament shall then form or at least refer the speech to specialized parliamentary committees, whereby sections of the speech, including that of easing the access to humanitarian organizations, will be addressed by relevant parliamentary committees.
Sierra says the government's process of issuing clearances for enemies officials entering South Sudan is tedious and overly bureaucratic. The South Sudan government signed a status of force agreement with the United Nations in 2011, which allows UN to deploy peacekeepers in the country and guarantees freedom of movement for UN peacekeepers. On Monday, three UN aid agencies declared famine exists in parts of South Sudan. The agencies say nearly half of the country's population is starving and they are unable to deliver food, medicine, and other emergency supplies to some of the most needy people because they were blocked by the government. Aid agencies say time is running out because heavy rains are expected in the next few months in parts of the country, which will make it difficult to distribute aid in areas affected by the famine. Wake Simon Wudu, VOA News, Juba.
Tanzanian opposition parliamentarians are calling on President John Magufuli's government to expedite the provision of grains to victims of a recent drought in the East African region. Countries in the region, including Kenya and South Sudan, face drought conditions which have affected food production. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has appealed to local and international partners to support his government's efforts to contain the situation. Tanzania opposition parliamentarians have urged their government to follow Kenya's example. Lawmaker Tundu Lissu tells viewers Peter Clotty that the government should stop playing politics with the country's food shortage problem.
The government said in parliament that approximately 1.2 million Tanzanians are facing food shortages in 55 districts. You're basically talking about slightly over one-third of the country is facing serious food shortages. And in terms, the government says that between now and April, about 35,000 tons are needed.
If this is what the government said to parliamentarians, why hasn't the government followed the lead of other nations like Kenya in the region who have declared their people need help with food aid in order to survive?
That's a very good question. But for some reason, we have a president who seems to think that it is beneath his dignity to seek help in this very serious crisis. And I personally raised it very, very publicly about his position, and I ended up being arrested.
So why are parliamentarians not asking the government to come up with solutions to meet this or resolve this food shortage in the country? Because I understand a lot of people are crying out for help.
When we're in parliament, the CCM members, who are the vast majority of parliamentarians, were instructed to say not a word about the serious food shortages, because the president has gone on public to say, as far as he's concerned, there is no food problem in the country until he says so. And since the president is not saying so, none of his ministers is, none of his administrative officers are saying anything about the deteriorating food situation.
But I understand the government is saying that there is enough food stored in the government food surplus system and that there's enough food for Tanzanians. Why isn't this a common knowledge, if I may ask, and why are Tanzanians going about saying there's no food?
Last year, the government bought only 90,000 tons of grain, down from 450,000 that was bought the previous year under the Kikwete administration. So last year, we only bought about a fifth of the total amount of food that we bought in 2015. Now, we are in very serious food situation, and we bought a fifth of what we bought in the previous year. When I was in parliament, one of the ministers spoke to me in confidence and said, actually, it's not 90,000 that is available, but the government reserve system is about 10,000 tons. They don't even know what to do with it because that will not last the country even 2 days. And there's been prolonged drought, and the situation is really dire in many, many parts of the country.
Tundu Lissu is an opposition Tanzanian parliamentarian. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today's Thursday, February 23rd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Malawi's president has fired his agriculture minister after investigators found cash worth nearly $200,000 in the minister's home. The raid was part of ongoing investigations into what has been deemed a suspicious maize procurement process from Zambia. Lamek Masina has the latest for VOA from Blantyre.
Malawi's agriculture minister, George Chabunda, is under investigation following a recommendation from a government commission of inquiry that was formed in January to probe the recent purchase of 100,000 tons of maize from Zambia. Chabunda is accused of flouting procurement procedures. Documents leaked to local media in December point to irregularities. They would appear to indicate that Malawi paid $13 million, more than it should have. Local media dubbed the scandal MaizeGate. Chabunda denied wrongdoing and refused calls to resign. His dismissal by the president comes just a day after the Anti-Corruption Bureau raided Chabunda's home. The SCB says it seized cash in various currencies, including $58,000 and 124 million Malawian kwacha. Police are also investigating a fire that gutted Chabunda's office last week, destroying documents. Bile Mayaya is the executive member of a group of 18 civil society organizations called the National Advocacy Platform that has long pushed for greater transparency in the maize procurement process.
I think the action of the president is too little too late, because level and extent of corruption in Malawi is so broad-based. It includes other high-level ministers who are still holding positions of power. Therefore, Chabunda is simply a poor guy for the rest of the DPP.
The DPP is the ruling party. Malawi's government has struggled to regain credibility after the massive cash gate scandal in 2013 caused foreign donors to cut large amounts of aid. When he took office the following year, President Peter Mutharika pledged zero tolerance on corruption and mismanagement. Sherif Kais is a political scientist. He says the handling of MaizeGate is encouraging.
We would recommend what the Anti-Corruption Bureau has done to have this good story that one of the people who have been there misappropriating government funds is finally out of the office.
But for Malawians, this new discovery of cash stashed in suitcases at a government official's home has called to mind and present memories of Cashgate and cast doubt on the progress made against corruption. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
A Ugandan church leader is welcoming as good news reports of a possible dialogue between opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye and longtime president Yoweri Museveni. Monsignor Matthew Odong, vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu, northern Uganda, says if the reports are true, it will be the best news for Ugandans in a long while. The Ugandan Monitor newspaper, citing sources close to both President Museveni and Dr. Besigye, said this week that the two political leaders have agreed to talk on a wide range of issues affecting the country with the help of a foreign mediator. Dr. Besigye, who has unsuccessfully challenged President Museveni in four elections, has said any talks with the government must focus on issues such as corruption, free and fair elections, and the rule of law. Monsignor Odong says Ugandans are tired of years of political violence.
I'm also reading from the same source as you do, Daily Monitor, that Besigye's Museveni set for dialogue. That would be the most welcome news for the people of Uganda, because we are tired of this conflict, hatred, division based on political parties. So dialogue would be the best means to solve this problem between Besigye and then President Museveni.
Monsignor, I get my question is, was the church involved in arranging such talks if they are to take place?
Well, I hope that the church will ask to get involved. But of course, the church has always promoted and continues to promote dialogue as the peaceful means to solving a situation of conflict, like the one that being referred to by the monitor. But at this point, on this particular subject, I don't have official information that the church has been directly asked. But I would think that the church will be one of the stakeholders or one of the parties to get involved to make this process move forward.
Following the elections in 2016 and the protests that followed, the church did meet with Dr. Besigye. Was this something discussed with Dr. Besigye?
Yes, I am saying that the church has always been involved, especially in the conflicting the political, situation here in Uganda. And the church has always made several attempts to bring the two parties together, to talk to each one of them separately, to embrace dialogue as the peaceful means to settling the conflict. And the church continues to do that, hoping that even this one that has officially come up now, the church too will be involved.
So, Monsignor, you are the church in Uganda. One would have thought that the church in Uganda would have played this role. What do you make of a foreign mediator?
Well, if it is the choice of the two parties that a foreign mediator be part of this or takes the lead, But of course, notwithstanding the participation of the church, the foreign mediator could be good in the sense that it doesn't create bias, because now which from which political party do you select to be the mediator? NRM? No. FBC? No. That will create bias. So a foreign mediator is somebody who is not taking part in any, but, you know, guided by the truth about the situation and the needs of Uganda.
If the speculations are right, the talks are probably going to center on political transition. That is because, according to the Constitution, President Museveni cannot run in the next election. What can be discussed in this kind of matter?
I don't want to preempt exactly what may come, you know, but I know the key issues is about term limits. One of the key issues that I would think that it would come, sharing of power. I think these are some of the things that may come, of which the church is always ready. Because, you know, a country is to be guided by a constitution. If there is a violation of a constitution, then you can see the future of the country is in disarray.
This is good news for Uganda if the talks do take place.
Yeah, this is good news for the people of Uganda. Because as I say, the Uganda people, we are tired of political conflict. You know, the magnitudes of violence during the campaign, during the election, it just really raises a big concern, you know, especially seeing the most innocent people who are the ones become victimized. And we, the religious leaders, the church in Uganda cannot just keep quiet when violation of human rights become a reality.
Monsignor Odong, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Monsignor Matthew Odong is vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu. He was speaking with me from northern Uganda. The commander of the United States Africa Command, which oversees military operations across Africa, has told VOA that the only way to peace in Libya is by bringing together the country's rival governments. General Thomas Wu-Heiser made the remarks at the recent Munich Security Conference ahead of Operation Flintlock, a joint military exercise being hosted by seven African nations. Henry Richwell reports from Munich.
Libya's political chaos remains entrenched. The internationally backed Government of National Accord controls only part of Tripoli, while rival power bases vie for the capital and other cities. In the east, General Khalifa Haftar, head of the Libyan National Army, holds sway over the House of Representatives. Speaking to VOA at the Munich Security Conference Sunday, General Thomas Waldhauser, commander of the United States Africa Command, said the U.S. is pushing for a unity deal.
There's no doubt about the fact that that Haftar and his influence, especially in the East, is something that has to be dealt with. And this is when we talk about a political solution that has to take place. This is where it all begins.
Haftar's forces control most of Libya's oil fields. Russian state-owned oil giant Rosneft signed a preliminary agreement with Libya's national oil company Tuesday to invest billions of dollars, the latest move by Moscow to reassert ties with Libya and further evidence of its strong backing for Haftar. General Waldhauser acknowledged that Russia would likely play a role in any solution.
We'd welcome anyone's. The goal is to get those two together. The goal is to get those two to talk, and the goal is to make some accommodation in that regard.
The U.S. has conducted a sustained air campaign against Islamic State militants in Libya and in January dispatched B-2 bombers on a 9,400-kilometer journey from a Missouri airbase to target training camps. The U.S. military's Africa Command is building partnerships in the Sahel region aimed at tackling terrorists, staging an annual joint exercise known as Operation Flintlock. Nigeria is a key regional partner, and the U.S. is providing intelligence support in the country's fight against Islamic State-affiliated terror group Boko Haram. At the Munich Security Conference, Nigerian Major General Babagana Monguno said the association of global terror groups means international cooperation is vital.
The uprising in Libya and the eventual capitulation of the Gaddafi government resulted in a southward flow of arms and human beings. The most natural place in sub-Saharan Africa for this flow was Nigeria.
Nigerian soldiers have been accused of abuses by human rights group Amnesty International in their fight against Boko Haram. General Waldhauser said the U.S. military takes such allegations seriously when working with partners.
We understand the requirement for battlefield ethics. We make it part of our training, and we try to continue to emphasize that in all that, and moreover, in just in aspects, but in the legal system, in our discussions with key leaders as well.
Operation Flintlock 2017 is about to get underway. The three-week exercise will bring together 2,000 service personnel from more than 20 African, European and North American partner nations. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Munich, Germany.
Daybreak Africa time, 25 minutes past the hour.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts and Trivia Question for today, February 23rd. On this day in 1868, William Edward Bogart Du Bois was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. His mother raised him on her own, instilling in him the values of hard work and education. William did well in high school and got a scholarship to Fisk University. He also attended Harvard University and became the first African-American to get a doctoral degree from Harvard. One of Du Bois's achievements was the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He also helped to educate America about the problems of black people. But some criticized him for speaking only for the educated. Du Bois became discouraged about what he called the American situation and took up citizenship in Ghana in 1963. On August 27 that same year, Du Bois died in Ghana. On this day in 1895, former slave and diplomat William H. Hurd was named Minister Resident and Consul General to Liberia by President Grover Cleveland. Hurd was born into slavery in Herbert County, Georgia. While in Monrovia, Hurd also served as superintendent of the Liberia Annual Conference of the African Methodist Episcopal Church and built the first AME church in Monrovia, the Eliza Turner Memorial Chapel. And today in Black History, we want to tell you about Benjamin Banneker. Banneker was born a free black man on November 9, 1731, in the state of Maryland. He was largely self-educated in astronomy and mathematics. Banneker was later called upon to assist in surveying for the construction of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Banneker's true acclaim, however, came from his almanacs, which he published for six consecutive years between 1792 and 1797. Banneker died in his sleep on October 9, 1806, just a month short of his 75th birthday. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 23rd. Congratulations to Randolph Coley of Banga City, Bon County in Liberia, Tamba M. Bakima of the UN Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Malik Sise of Accra, Ghana. You are the winners of our February 22nd question, who is the first black person to head the United States Peace Corps? The answer, Carolyn Robertson Pitton. Now here is our question for today, February 23rd. African-American Douglas L. Wilder was governor of which U.S. state? Once again, African-American Douglas L. Wilder was governor of which U.S. state? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Thursday, February 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the latest political developments in Somalia as the country moves forward under the leadership of newly elected President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmaajo. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.